Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Troy Bramston makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on quite a few occasions, and it's great to have him back. Now, he's here on the occasion tonight of the publication of Robert Menzies' The Art of Politics. He's well known to many of you, so I'll introduce him briefly. Troy Bramston has been a senior writer and columnist with the Australian newspaper and a contributor to Sky News since 2011, and before that he was a columnist with the Sunday Telegraph. He's the author or editor of 9 books, including Paul Keating, The Big Picture Leader, and he co-authored with Paul Kelly, The Dismissal in the Queen's Name. And tonight, Troy Bramston's going to speak to the Sydney Institute on the topic of revising the life and legacy of Robert Menzies. Troy, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you, Jared, for that warm introduction, and thank you all for coming this evening. The Sydney Institute, as you all know, plays a very important role encouraging debate and discussion on economic, cultural and political ideas and matters of history in this great city. So I especially thank Jared and Anne for inviting me back to speak to you at the Sydney Institute. This is, I think, the 6th time that I've spoken here, and it's a real privilege to do so. But I must admit some trepidation about speaking here about Robert Menzies. Jared and Anne have both written very good books about Menzies, or which deal with Menzies and the Liberal Party. I am fully prepared for a critical analysis of anything that I say and write about Menzies, and I am fair game. So let me reiterate again, Jared and Anne, how much I admire both of you, admire your books, and admire the Sydney Institute. Now, I may not be the likeliest person to write a biography of Robert Menzies, the first in 20 years. My last book, after all, was a biography of Paul Keating, who sends his apologies, by the way. He's a huge Menzies fan. And he's a great admirer of the Sydney Institute as well. But Robert Menzies continues to loom large in Australian public life. He defined and dominated an era in Australian politics, and he has never been matched for his record term as Prime Minister or his election victories. And he remains the only Prime Minister to leave office at a time of their own choosing in the post-war period. However, debate over Menzies' life and legacy has never settled, which makes him a compelling biographical subject. Some see him as the personification of statesmanship in the 20th century, and others see him as snap-frozen in time, as a stuffy Edwardian figure not in tune with the emerging Australia of the 1950s and 60s. Liberal leaders routinely invoke Menzies and enlist him to their cause. Interpreting Menzies is core business for every Liberal leader. John Howard and Tony Abbott have continued to invoke Menzies as the epitome of conservatism. Malcolm Fraser viewed him as the personification of what it means to be a Liberal. For Malcolm Turnbull, Menzies was a political centrist. And Scott Morrison has steered a middle path and said the things that we believe in today are the things that he believed in then. Whatever that means. The upshot is that Menzies' true philosophical bearing remains contested inside the party that he led longer than anybody else. It is also not surprising that some Labor leaders seek to delegitimise Menzies' legacy because it remains so important to the Liberal tradition. In truth, I argue that Menzies is more substantial than his critics allow and has more faults than his admirers accept. The continuing debate over Menzies' place in history, his achievements and his failures, and his enduring legacy underscores his significance. So in this book, I tried to provide a balanced account of his life and his legacy. I try to do so fairly, but rigorously and without partisan idolatry or mockery. I tried to capture the real Menzies, who he was, how he lived, what his values were, his virtues and his vices, how he gained and used political power, and what his legacy is today. When he retired in the summer of 1966, he bestrode the political stage like a colossus. He had served as Prime Minister over two separate terms, from 1939 to 1941, and from 1949 to 1966. He was the principal founder of the Liberal Party and led it to seven election wins. He presided over a nation imperiled by war and prosperous in peace. He was a politician who was admired and respected at home and abroad, although not universally loved. Still, he had immense authority and stature. Australians viewed him as a safe, trusting, and reassuring leader. He even looked prime ministerial. He was over 6 feet tall and had a bulky 20 stone frame. He had fleshy jowls, short silvery grey hair, and piercing blue eyes, underneath black bushy eyebrows that could intimidate all on their own. He wore buttoned up double breasted suits, usually with a crisp white shirt, a dark tie, and a pocket handkerchief. He smoked fat cigars, mixed a lethal martini, and liked a Scotch whisky in the evening. He often wore a felt Homburg hat and carried walking sticks, some engraved with RGM. This sartorial elegance augmented his gravitas and presence. He spoke in a honeyed voice with crisp expressiveness that was British in tone but uniquely Australian in its inflection. He filled any room, was often imposing, and always the centre of attention. For generations of Australians, Menzies was the Prime Minister. He governed during a period of golden age of economic growth, low unemployment, increasing wages, rising living standards, a massive influx of migrants, and an expanding home-owning middle class. He has a number of signature policy achievements. There was a huge expansion of universities and colleges, a tenfold increase in federal funding to universities, the number of universities doubled from 6 to 12, student numbers exploded, and three quarters were in receipt of scholarships to subsidise their education. Funding was provided to non-government schools for the first time, although limited, which helped to end the sectarian divide. Although the New South Wales Labor government supported state aid, the issue divided Labor nationally, and Menzies saw an opportunity to not only do what was right, but what was also politically astute. Canberra was developed into a true national capital. Public servants were relocated to Canberra. New national institutions were established. Lake Burley Griffin was created, and huge investments were made in local infrastructure. The United States alliance was cemented with the ANZUS Treaty. New relationships were forged in the Asia-Pacific region, which Menzies visited more than any other Prime Minister at that time, with initiatives such as the Commerce Agreement with Japan and the Colombo Plan. There were also mistakes and misjudgments, which all Prime Ministers make. I think it's a tragedy that almost 60,000 Australians were sent to the Vietnam War, a conflict that was never properly understood, ended in catastrophic failure and divided Australians. Menzies' belief in the domino theory, even after 1975, was a significant strategic misjudgment. His biggest political misstep, I argue, was his attempt to ban the Communist Party, which saw him depart from liberal principles and was rejected by the voters. I found that Menzies, whilst respected and admired on the world stage, was perhaps less successful in foreign policy than he was in domestic policy. He did not convince John F. Kennedy to support the Dutch remaining in New Guinea or help defend Malaysia against Indonesia. His mission to Cairo to resolve the Suez Crisis, when he sided with the British and French over the United States, ended in humiliation. It is also regrettable that he was reluctant to take a stronger moral and diplomatic stand against South Africa's apartheid policy. And his views on Aboriginal Australians and the White Australia policy are jarring today, although they are understandable for a man born in 1894. Menzies resisted attempts by his own ministers to change the White Australia policy, to expand the Aboriginal referendum, or to take a stronger stand against South Africa. And after he retired in 1966, the Cabinet moved very swiftly to change course in these areas of policy ossification. Menzies was a traditionalist and a sentimentalist, but he was not a reactionary. He was a cautious reformer. This, I think, is an important assessment of who Menzies was, what he believed in, and how he governed. Menzies advocated liberalism within a conservative economic and social framework. The economy remained shackled to highly regulated capital, product, and labour markets. The budget for most of the period was in deficit, and the top marginal income tax rate was 67% or higher. Menzies' longevity was also partly gifted by an opposition plagued by division and saddled with lacklustre leaders, Arthur Corwell and Bert Everett, which he successfully exploited. Now, much of what Menzies believed in and the policies that his government introduced have been jettisoned by both major parties. Perhaps Menzies' most contemporarily relevant legacy is how he practiced politics rather than the enduring nature of his policies. But learning the art of politics came only after hard work, self-reflection, and determination. Menzies knew what he stood for, and he could communicate it clearly. He was a talented administrator of government who prized the cabinet process and respected the public service. He was a shrewd tactician and campaigner. He was the driving force behind the creation of the Liberal Party and managed it effectively. He also understood that a good relationship with the Country Party was essential to good government. So understanding how Menzies mastered the art of politics, especially developing, articulating, and implementing policy while leading a government of longevity, could not be more relevant today. Now, a large part of Menzies' success was that he was a brilliant parliamentary debater, public speaker, and broadcaster. His town hall meetings were legendary. They would be packed with supporters, opponents, and the undecided. Some went for entertainment and brought sandwiches, tea, and coffee. Menzies' speeches would be punctuated by cheers and boos, abuse and laughter. Attendees waved placards that read, "Pig Iron Bob" or "Ming the Merciless." Sometimes eggs or tomatoes would be thrown at him, but Menzies was in his element and he was rarely fazed. He gained a reputation for his sharp wit, which was not always to his advantage, even if it gained him a few laughs. "I wouldn't vote for you if you were the Archangel Gabriel," a woman once said to him. Menzies replied, "If I were the Archangel Gabriel, madam, I'm afraid you would not be in my constituency." A miner interjected one day, "Tell us all you know, Bob. It won't take long." Menzies responded, "I'll tell you everything we both know, and it won't take any longer." And on another occasion, a woman kept interrupting from the front row. Menzies said, "Madam, I'm sure your husband is very glad that you are here with us today." The primary motivation for writing this book was discovering a series of interviews that Menzies gave in 1972 and 1973 that have not been published before. He commissioned journalist Frances McNichol to write his biography in 1969. She interviewed Menzies and she did some research, but the book was never written. In the interviews, though, Menzies talked about his upbringing. He reflected on political events, policies, personalities, and offered political lessons drawn from his experience. For example, Menzies was unsparing when it came to providing assessments of his successes, some of which has been known. But in retirement, Menzies watched in horror as the Liberal Party was plagued with instability, cycled through a series of short-term leaders, and tumbled to defeat in 1972. Menzies said he was bitterly disappointed with Harold Holt, who fell from one disaster to another. He thought it was a terrible blunder to make John Gordon Prime Minister, who lacked discipline in his public and his private life. Billy McMahon was dismissed as a fool, untrustworthy, lacking in intellect and judgment, and without a shred of credibility. And Billy Snedden was dismissed as just hopeless. None of them, Menzies thought, were up to being Prime Minister. The Liberal grandee thought that the party was being run by, quote, idiots who believed in nothing, and he voted for the Democratic Labor Party in 1972, and possibly also in 1969 and 1974. He thought the Liberal Party should merge with the Country Party and form a coalition with the DLP. But over time, Menzies thought that Liberal salvation would only come with Malcolm Fraser, and he was thrilled when Fraser became leader in 1975. But Heather Henderson, Robert Menzies' daughter, told me that her father was soon disappointed with Fraser too, and recalled him sitting in front of the television and saying, "Malcolm can do nothing right." Menzies also revealed in these interviews that he did not feel secure in the leadership of the Liberal Party until at least the 1949 election. Indeed, there were reports of a leadership challenge, possibly from Percy Spender, in 1950 and 1951. Menzies had actually resigned as Liberal leader in 1947 and demanded that the party get behind him. "You can't win with Menzies" was a common refrain before 1949. But nobody did challenge Menzies, and he remained Liberal leader. But Menzies said some in the party still wanted to replace him before the 1949 election with Don Bradman or Tom Playford, the South Australian Premier. Dick Casey was also mentioned sometimes as an alternative leader. Now, one of the most important revelations, I think, is that Menzies was deeply affected by his decision not to serve in the First World War. His two older brothers, Les and Frank, had enlisted for service abroad. Belle, his sister, meanwhile, had eloped with a soldier and was banished from the family. The family was plunged into emotional turmoil. Menzies revealed that his father was so stricken with grief that he nearly died. It was decided that Robert, then a university student, would remain in Melbourne to look after the family. About 40% of young men in Australia enlisted to serve in the First World War. And Frank Menzies was so concerned about his brother Robert not enlisting that he sent him a letter home releasing him from his promise and urging him to sign up. But the letter never arrived. Menzies was unfairly branded as a coward for not enlisting. "This," he said, "had a very searing effect on me." So he decided to go into politics, viewing it as, quote, "public service of some kind," and to erase the perceived stain that he thought was on his name. Menzies said, "I just had to do something to justify my existence. I decided that I ought to go into parliament." So the First World War was the decisive event that propelled Menzies into politics. I don't think this has been fully appreciated by all historians and biographers. Menzies himself said in one of these unpublished interviews that this was not a reason he went into politics, but the reason. The decision not to enlist continued to have an effect on him. A key reason Menzies went overseas during the Second World War as Prime Minister, spending months abroad while his colleagues grew restless at home, was to show that he did not lack courage. Menzies said he had to prove that he was not yellow. He wanted to set an example and not run away from any danger. He was, in other words, chasing his demons. There is another way that Menzies' non-enlistment impacted upon his personal life, and I've only learnt this in detail since the book was published. While at Melbourne University, Menzies was engaged to a fellow student, Phyllis Lewis, but the engagement did not last, and nobody really knows why. Alan Martin, in his terrific two-volume biography of Menzies, gave it only a passing mention. I did not dwell on it in my biography either. But Lewis's family have been in contact with me since my book was published, and they've shared with me the story that has been passed down through the years. Their story is that Menzies nervously proposed marriage during a university party that was accepted because Lewis did not want to hurt his feelings. But her reservations grew in subsequent months. Lewis had two older brothers, and one was killed in France during the war. Legend has it that the brother appeared to her in a dream and told her not to marry Menzies. Meanwhile, a boy she had admired years earlier, who had served in the war, returned home, and her relationship with him was rekindled and cemented. So Menzies' lack of wartime service may have contributed to his engagement to Phyllis Lewis being broken off, or so the story goes. Menzies' vast collection of personal papers is housed in 687 boxes at the National Library of Australia. I'm surprised that many historians or biographers have simply not looked at this material or had access to it. I was lucky to be granted full access to this treasure trove, and I discovered fragments of memoirs, notes, letters, reports, and verse that have not been published before. Sitting in the National Library or the National Archives, surrounded by boxes of files, offers a window into the past. It's like Disneyland for the professional historian. So let me give you a few examples of these discoveries. I was able to view for the first time all of Menzies' correspondence with his sister, Belle Green. They reveal an account of Menzies' visit to Nazi Germany in 1938, where he downplayed the Nazi threat in Europe. He also offered a degree of praise for Adolf Hitler and wrote that abandonment of individual liberty has something magnificent about it. Now, the Menzies family understandably knew that this letter did not reflect well on him, and so it's remained sealed for many years. The letters also reveal that Menzies gave money to his sister Belle for most of her life to supplement her income. Paddy Menzies did not approve of this arrangement. I also discovered a memo that Menzies had written after the 1943 election as opposition leader. He knew that the United Australia Party was a spent force and that a new political party had to be created on the centre-right of politics. In this memo, Menzies outlined the structure, philosophy and ethos of the party that would become the Liberal Party in 1944. However, Menzies then thought it should be called the Liberal Democratic Party. In Menzies' papers, I also found unpublished notes and memos about the Suez Crisis, how he was awarded a knighthood, and his distaste for modern journalism in the 1970s. In the Fairfax Media Archive at the State Library of New South Wales, I found records of regular donations to the Liberal Party in the 1940s that would add up to around $100,000 today. And in Billy McMahon's extensive papers at the National Library, which still remain partly sealed, I discovered a memo he had written about the founding of the Liberal Party. In 1944, a meeting was organised by businessman W.C. Robinson and attended by the big media proprietors of the day, Keith Murdoch from the Herald and Weekly Times, Frank Packer from Australian Consolidated Press, and Rupert Henderson representing Fairfax. The purpose was to discuss how organisations on the liberal side of politics, as they called it, could join together to replace the United Australia Party with a new political party. Menzies was the only politician invited to attend. He outlined his proposal for a new party, which they enthusiastically supported. But documents can only tell you so much about a man, his life, and his legacy. So with my wife, Nikki, who's here tonight, my children, Madison and Angus, we visited Japarit in January this year. Now, visiting a small, remote, quiet country town, some 350 kilometres from Melbourne, is what I regard as a great family holiday. And frankly, this was the second biggest thing to happen to Japarit. So Japarit gave us a great insight into Menzies. It is extraordinary, really, that a boy born in the back of the family's general store in a small country town in 1894 could become Prime Minister, the last born in the 19th century. It's often forgotten that Menzies was not part of the Born to Rule Brigade. He was not part of the establishment. Indeed, his application to join the Melbourne Club was initially rejected. And again, it is suggested that his non-war service had played a part in that. The Menzies family was not particularly wealthy. Menzies went to a school in Ballarat and Melbourne and to university by winning scholarships, studying hard and by his own determination. In Japarit, we visited the site of the Menzies family store and the Mechanics Institute where Menzies read books. We walked up and down Roy and Charles streets and we saw the spire that Menzies had unveiled in 1966. We visited the local school where a phrenologist had run his head over Menzies' boyhood skull and when he lifted it off, he proclaimed that he would become a barrister and public speaker later in life. We appreciated the assistance of locals Wendy Zanker and Wendy Werner, both with an abiding interest in Jeparit's history, who respectively run the local historical society and museum, and they facilitated our visit. We visited the largely disused town hall and looked at an original records and photos from Menzies' time, and saw a petition to the governor that Menzies' father had signed, urging him to make Jeparit a town. It was also important to talk to those who knew Menzies. So I conducted several interviews with Menzies' daughter, Heather Henderson, still sprightly at age 90. Heather revealed that her mother, Dame Patty, could make life difficult for her father, and that Patty and Belle had hated one another. That's her words. And now there are only three ministers left from the Menzies government, and it's been a privilege to talk to Doug Anthony and Ian Sinclair, two grand old men of Australian politics, about the Menzies era. Anthony told me that Menzies was consultative in cabinet, but could be brutal with ministers who were not across their brief. He also thought that Menzies liked to make ministers look like fools if he thought they deserved it. Sinclair said to me that Dame Patty took a close interest in the development of Canberra. She would not hesitate to complain to her husband if she was unhappy that the garbage hadn't been collected, the power went off, or the footpaths and roads were not up to scratch. So these would be the number one items at Cabinet the next day. Jim Forbes is the only surviving Liberal minister from the Menzies government. The afternoon that I spent with him in Adelaide on the eve of his 95th birthday last year is one that I shall also treasure. Forbes remembered that Menzies' support to ministers in difficulty, like when he was selling national service, was absolute. Menzies would stick with you, he said. Forbes, who was Minister for the Army, recalled very little discussion, let alone opposition, about the decision to commit troops to Vietnam. He also said the main reason was to show that Australia was a dependable ally and to strengthen the alliance with the United States. I conducted the last interview with Sir John Carrick, a true gentleman of Australian politics, who also gave me a very unique perspective on Menzies and the Liberal Party in its formative years. Carrick said that in the 1940s, Menzies had real enemies and there were substantial doubts about his capacity to lead the party. When Menzies provided state aid to non-government schools, Carrick recalled that he had proceeded cautiously. Menzies told him, "I don't want a war to start." I learned a lot by interviewing public servants Lennox Hewitt and Richard Walcott, who both worked with Menzies. Hewitt, now 101, knew Menzies' father when they both worked at BHP together. Hewitt thought the father-son relationship was somewhat strained, but James Menzies was immensely proud of his son, Robert. And his staff, William Heseltine and Tony Eggleton, took me inside the Prime Minister's office to illuminate what it was really like. They both admired Menzies greatly, but were frank in their interviews with me. Heseltine thought that Menzies was a very shy person. One of the implications of this was that he tended to criticise people behind their back. Heseltine said this was a weakness of character. Heseltine also said that Menzies had a close and admiring relationship with his first deputy, Eric Harrison, but not so much with Harold Holt. Heather Henderson agrees with this assessment. Heseltine also agreed that the Queen, whom he had later worked for as her official secretary in Buckingham Palace, was embarrassed by Menzies' "I did but see her passing by" speech in 1963. Tony Eggleton also had some great anecdotes to share. He said that Menzies would always stop his prime ministerial car just before he would reach a destination where Menzies was to speak, outside. He would then hop out and Eggleton would follow him and liberally apply fly spray on his back so that no flies would distract the audience from listening to his speech. Eggleton also organised Menzies' farewell press conference, broadcast live on national television, the largest ever viewing audience at that time. He told me that Menzies insisted on having a nervous pee after he left his office and before he walked to the parliamentary dining room and sat down to a live television audience. Now, these interviews, documents and the visit to Jeparit helped me to understand the real man behind the handsome, imposing, dominating public figure. Menzies' upbringing in Japarit, the influence of his family, his education and his time as a lawyer tell the story of a Protestant middle-class boy with gleaming potential and determination. In state and federal politics, we see another Menzies emerge, filled with ambition and intelligence, but held back by his poor relations with colleagues. When told by an MP that he did not suffer fools gladly, Menzies replied, "What do you think I'm doing now?" His first prime ministership ended in resignation and rejection, but it led to the formation of the Liberal Party, the development of a new political creed and a pathway back to political power. And his lengthy second prime ministership reveals yet another Menzies. We see him grapple with complex issues at home and abroad during a period of political turmoil. He cycled from victory to near defeat on two occasions, only to consolidate again and again and retire undefeated. Menzies always learned from his mistakes, an essential virtue in any other politician. He also thought that politics should be a battle of ideas rather than a clash of personalities or political slogans. He cherished friendships on the opposite side of politics, especially with John Curtin and Ben Chifley. I discovered a remarkable letter that Menzies sent to Curtin as he lay sick in bed at the lodge in 1945. Menzies reassured Curtin that Chifley was doing extremely well in Parliament and asked him not to worry and urged him to rest. Curtin died a week later. When Chifley died at the Kurrajong Hotel during Parliament's Jubilee Ball, Menzies interrupted the band and told the partygoers to go home as a mark of respect for the loss of a great Australian. Menzies cried that night in King's Hall and did not matter who saw him. These were remarkable men, and their friendships tell us much about an era in Australian politics that is sadly long gone. In conclusion, I think we've waited far too long for a new biography of Robert Menzies. I hope that all of you and other readers will have a better understanding as to who Menzies really was, what he stood for, and what he achieved. Winston Churchill once counselled a young student, "Study history, because in history lie all the secrets to statecraft." So thank you all for coming. I hope you enjoy the biography as much as I did writing it. Thank you.
Many thanks to Troy Bramson. As I said, we've got copies of Robert Menzies' The Art of Politics, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign copies after the event. So we'll end no later than the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. Can I just lead off, because I think your most substantial criticism of the Menzies government, the second Menzies government, was the commitment to Vietnam. And you quote Minister Forbes as saying that we did this essentially because of our alliance with the United States. But my reading of the cabinet documents in that period is that the motivating factor for committing troops, ground forces, 1965, was that Indonesia was under the rule of Sukarno, had the second largest communist party in the world. It was a Muslim nation, a majority Muslim nation. Sukarno's regime was very aggressive. And the view in the cabinet was, because as you point out, President Kennedy wasn't all that helpful, the view in the cabinet was that if we committed forces to Vietnam, the United States was much more likely to help us if we got into trouble with Indonesia. So the driving motivation, also for conscription, but not only for conscription, for the actual commitment of forces, was not our relationship, in a sense, with the United States, but our dependence on the United States to help us if we were in trouble. So what are your readings of the Menzies stuff tell you about this?
Thanks, Jared. Well, look, this is a difficult and complex issue, and it's also an emotive one. I don't think the Menzies cabinet seriously considered this commitment in great detail. That was the impression I got from Jim Forbes and from reading the documents myself. Menzies gave an interview at the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library in retirement where he was asked about it, and Menzies just said, look, as soon as this issue came up, we decided we had to be in it. And I don't think they really seriously thought through the implications or understood the conflict. Menzies, in his argument for why Australia should contribute troops to the Vietnam War, was essentially the domino theory. And he argued that if the North overran the South in Vietnam, that Australia would be imperiled. Now, that was a silly argument, and that didn't happen, of course. So his whole one of his main strategic arguments for the war was not fulfilled. And so, you know, I'm quite critical of the government for doing that. But there are others too, and I know you're not a big fan of Malcolm Fraser, but he had regrets about the war as well, largely because he didn't think that that the Australian government was being fully told what was actually happening in Vietnam. And that's reflected also, I think, in the official history by Peter Edwards, who argues that the Menzies government didn't seriously consider all of the issues, the nature of the conflict, what the outcome was, didn't get a great sense of control over the deployment of Australian troops. And interestingly, the last point I'll make on this, because we want to be brief, is that Garfield Barwick, who, of course, was External Affairs Minister, just before the decision was made, he didn't support the decision either to send troops to Vietnam, because he knew that conscription or national service would divide the Australian community, and he didn't think that Australian troops should be involved in a ground war in Asia of that kind. And he made these remarks to Frances McNichol when she was researching her unfinished biography of Robert Menzies.
So we go to the next question. Actually got on quite well with Malcolm Fraser, but Fraser's opposition. Fraser was the strongest supporter of Australia's Vietnam commitment between 1965 and 1980. In later life, he changed his position, but that wasn't his position at the time. So here's a question here. Just hang on a second.
Thanks, Jerry. Troy, just again on Vietnam, I recently saw on SBS a tremendous documentary on Vietnam, and at the outset they were saying that America Eisenhower committed the first troops to Vietnam at the behest of de Gaulle, who said that if the US didn't help France save its empire, then France would align itself with Russia and Germany would be encircled. Is there anything of this in anything you've seen? I mean, I was amazed at this. I'd never heard of this.
Yeah, well, of course, the French had a big defeat at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, so which was largely the key reason why they decided to leave. Yeah, look, I mean, there's a lot of debates and there's a lot of history. It's a very complex subject that does go on a long time with many US presidents and so on. But I just don't think the Menzies government fully understood what was actually going on there. And that documentary you refer to, essentially put together by Ken Burns, I think argues the case quite strongly that the US didn't really understand what was happening in Vietnam. It was a conflict not really about communism, but was about nationalism. And one of the strongest arguments that Menzies gave publicly was to defeat communism. And you know, because the Chinese were essentially downward thrusting in the region, and none of that was essentially true. And of course, within a few years after the war ended, Vietnam was at war with China. So I just don't think he strategically grappled with this issue well enough. It was a decision made late in his prime ministership, and I think he was partly checked out by then, and he was so dominant in cabinet, there wouldn't have been any significant opposition to what he wanted to do. And there's also a bit of a dispute about the decision that was made, because essentially, and this came out in the cabinet documents, that essentially the Menzies government decided to send combat troops to Vietnam before it was actually formally asked to do so.
Thank you for your book. And I just have one criticism. It wasn't long enough because I knocked it over in 4 days. I couldn't put the damn thing down. So I can ask for it twice the length next time.
Sure.
What I noticed, and you did mention in your book, was the character of members of Parliament coming through now is distinct from the old days. That is, people like Chifley and Curtin and Menzies, and a lot of these people seem to have character and integrity, which today I think it's easier winning lotto than finding someone with those characteristics. Even like a former Prime Minister, when he worked for David Jones, had his file marked never to be re-employed again. Yet this country made him Prime Minister to our detriment. What do you think? Can you just explain a little bit more the character and the way MPs are and the way they get to be an MP and all that stuff?
Yeah, look, I think politics was a very different time. And you're referring to Paul Keating there, I know that one. Look, politics is a very different era, and I think the people were different as well. And you know, Canberra was a very isolated place. You know, when Menzies became Prime Minister in 1949, sheep still grazed on the paddocks around Parliament House. There were essentially only two hotels, the Kurrajong Hotel and the Hotel Canberra. Politicians spent a lot of time with each other. There was no social media, so politics was less bitter, less vitriolic. And so the character of politics, I think, lends itself to those kind of relationships. But there's no doubt that there was a very close relationship between Menzies and Curtin and Menzies and Chifley, certainly not with Bert Evatt at all, and I write about that in the book, won't go on about that, and a friendship with Arthur Corwell that was not as warm as it was with Chifley and Curtin, but it was a genuine friendship. But I think it just says something about the character of the men. You know, they fought politics as hard as anybody fights politics today. That 1943 election campaign was pretty hard fought. You know, the opposition at the time accused the Curtin government of starving Australian troops abroad. The government accused the then opposition of leaving Australia vulnerable to attack by the Japanese. So this is pretty hardball politics. But after that, you know, they could sit down at the end of the day and have a cup of tea or have a drink together and be friends. And we have lost a lot of that. Although, interestingly, I did interview Josh Frydenberg a week or so ago, who launched the book, and we got into quite a detailed, long discussion that got a little bit emotional, and he told me how much he loves Labor's Ed Husic. So there you go. I mean, there are examples, I think, of friendships around today, but nothing like there was in Menzies' time.
There's a question back here. Better be brief.
Yeah. How do you think Menzies would have run the present election campaign?
Well, judging on his record, he probably would win it, for starters. But look, I mean, there are a couple of lessons here. I mean, the book is subtitled The Art of Politics because there are contemporary lessons for how Menzies, you know, practiced himself in government and as a politician. I think the most important one is a core of belief. He knew exactly what he stood for, and he could communicate it effectively. Now, I would struggle these days to argue what the coalition really believes in. Certainly, we're all aware of examples where they've been divided among themselves. You just got to look at Malcolm Turnbull's Twitter feed, where he's saying how great electric cars are, and that's a key Labor policy. So, you know, that's just the former Prime Minister from 6 months ago. So there's not a coherence, I think, particularly on the coalition side at the moment. John Howard had certainly philosophical coherence and a core set of beliefs, and he stuck to those. So that's been lost. And also being able to articulate and communicate effectively. Politicians these days are too hemmed in by key lines, slogans. They've got their talking points, you know, and they get in trouble if they go outside of that and actually try to have a debate, have an argument. And one of the things that Menzies and other successful prime ministers, whether it's Howard or Hawke or Keating, is that they could have an argument. You know, there's got to be an argument at the centre of politics. You've got to be able to persuade people. And we've got away from that, I think, in politics, where too many politicians just think if you sprout a few key lines, that's enough to win over the voters, and it's not. So, look, there's a couple of pointers there. And in the book, I also write about how we manage government very effectively too. So, you know, running a proper cabinet process, respecting the public service, allowing discussion and debate in cabinet, being unified and so on. So there are some pointers in the book on that.
We go there, then we go to Chris. Yes?
So you spoke about the anti-Communist Party referendum was his great mistake. The irony of all that was, though, he was an anti-communist, which was one of the reasons in the 30s why many of the anti-communists were softer on fascism than later they became. And he did send the troops. But the irony of Menzies is that he really had that long period as Prime Minister because the Labor Party split. And the Labor Party split because it couldn't handle communism. It couldn't handle the infiltration of communism in its own party. And Evatt, of course, had been playing funny politics in 1941, so he didn't have any great love of Evatt either. So how do you see that in terms of his longevity, the role, not so much his being able to win elections, but the Labor Party's inability to stay united?
Yeah, there's no doubt the Labor split is a large factor in Menzies' success and longevity as Prime Minister. There's no doubt about that at all. But it's interesting, though, you know, having said all that, is that how close the Menzies government came on two occasions to almost losing. in 1954 and in 1961. So, you know, if a couple of seats had have gone a different way, I mean, Bert Everett or Arthur Calwell could have been Prime Minister, and Menzies' legacy would have been very different. So that's actually quite interesting when you look at it in that context. But there's no doubt the Labor split, it's certainly how it approached the issue of communism, was a big factor. But I also wouldn't downplay, and I don't think you do either, Anne, about Everett himself, whether Everett was suitable to the job of being opposition leader, whether he could lead an effective team. You know, he was challenged almost, I think, five or six times, I think, by his party room. Had a very divided, very bitter party room. Couldn't unite the Labor forces. You know, yet he almost won an election. So there's something about the personality of Everett as well I don't think was suited to national politics.
Chris?
Troy, one of the foundations, allegedly, of the Liberal Party was to be a supporter of federalism. Now, it seems to me Menzies, both with the education reforms, the Martin and the Murray Committee reports, and then subsequently in his book Central Power in the Commonwealth, I think going back to the engineers' case, if anybody put the sword to federalism in a practical sense, it seems to me that Menzies actually did that. I wondered if you had any reflections about the sort of mantra in the Liberal Party about being in favour of federalism and never actually introducing any policies which reinforce it.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting reflection on Menzies, particularly in education. And when I went back and looked exactly at what the Menzies government had done in education, I was quite surprised about the massive, you know, increase in funding to universities and colleges. You know, a tenfold increase in funding. The number of universities doubled from 6 to 12. So these are big policy initiatives. And I was lucky to get an endorsement for the book from Clive James, who made an important point in his endorsement by saying that that, you know, Menzies gave a whole generation of young Australians a tertiary education. And then they spent the rest of their lives denigrating him, having given them that. So, you know, that's an interesting point. But you're right. I mean, Menzies was not, didn't, a little, there's little reference in Menzies' speeches or statements about the importance of federalism. Although clearly the Liberal Party was, you know, still is largely a collection of state-based political parties. But again, I think it's a testament to Menzies' dominance, you know, and his authority. You know, as a political leader, that he could decide which way to go, and largely the party followed him. So, yeah, look, it's an interesting reflection on that.
Lindsay?
How do you deal with the regular criticism of Menzies that he failed to implement any form of succession plan for his leadership?
Yeah, look,
in case that wasn't picked up, the failure of Menzies to implement a succession plan for his leadership.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question. I say in the book, I think Menzies probably should have retired after the 1963 election. I think he would be better served by history at that stage. He would have avoided the Vietnam War. He would have avoided the Aboriginal referendum, the changing nature of the Commonwealth. And he basically said in these interviews that he's an old Commonwealth man, but accepted the winds of change grudgingly, sweeping through the Commonwealth. And so he was increasingly out of time, I think. And it's important to note that, you know, the Menzies cabinet, you know, rejected changes to the White Australia policy, rejected changes to the Aboriginal referendum, which would have had a not only just counted Aboriginal people in the census, but enabled the constitution to be amended to remove discriminatory provisions. He rejected all that, yet the whole cabinet moved very, very swiftly to reverse those decisions that the Menzies government had made. So I think he was out of time, and he would have been served well by an earlier departure. In terms of his ability to groom successors, well, you just got to look at his own words. I mean, he didn't think Holt, Gorton, or McMahon were particularly good leaders. There was a criticism that he didn't promote enough talent in the Liberal Party. People like Don Chipp and others had been critical about the Menzies cabinets in the latter years being too full of old men. The Country Party was very successful. You know, Doug Anthony, John McEwen had promoted Doug Anthony and Ian Sinclair. They were very much younger men, but Menzies didn't do that so much in the Liberal Party. And, you know, there is this continual debate. Did he try to move people on who might be leadership threats to him? I don't buy into that argument, but I do think he was served well by moving some people on to other positions, including Garfield Barwick, and Casey, indeed, in an earlier period. But Barwick himself says that he thought he would be Menzies' successor, and that Menzies had said that, and maybe he would have been better. I don't know, but I don't think Menzies was particularly good in grooming a new generation of Liberals, and that became very quickly evident after he retired.
Before we go to the next question, of course, the other person he did not promote was Malcolm Fraser.
Indeed, yes.
I'm just going to ask your observations about Menzies' relationship with the union movement, and given the membership was huge in those days, he seemed to have a good relationship with Albert Monk, the ACTU president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Albert Monk was not at all like his successor, Bob Hawke. Albert Monk was a very shy and sort of unassuming man who liked to do deals with governments, and he got on very well with Menzies indeed. It was interesting, the union movement are different today than they were then, but it's very, very interesting to go back and look at some of the Liberal Party advertising in the 1949 election, and I found this great advertisement where Menzies says the Liberal Party supports union members and supports unionism. And wanted to, encourage unionism, support it, promote it, help it. So that's quite remarkable stuff. And you'd never see that today, of course, from a Liberal leader. And John Carrick actually said to me in that last interview that he was disappointed that the Liberal Party today seems to have a confrontational approach to trade unions. And he argued very strongly that Menzies never saw a war between capitalism and labour, and he wanted the Liberal Party to be more pro-worker, in his views. So, look, it's interesting, but it's a different time in politics than it is today.
There's a question here.
One of the obvious difficulties of modern politics is the inability of governments to control both houses of parliament. Can you tell us for what period in the second Menzies government, for what time of that 17 years, Menzies did have control of the Senate?
Yeah, he didn't always have control of the Senate. There was a period where he did. And in fact, there's a number of redistributions through that time which made it more difficult as well. But interestingly, the Labor Party in the early years had a majority in the Senate, after the Menzies government came to power. And that made life difficult, particularly with the Communist Party referendum and having to accept a number of Labor amendments there. But the Senate just doesn't feature as an institution then as it does now. There's no minor parties other than the DLP for part of that period. There's no crazy personalities trying to obstruct legislation. And quite often the Labor Party would just let the coalition policies go through the Senate, the bills go through the Senate. Not always, though. It's interesting to note that the Labor Party opposed the commerce agreement with Japan, but Menzies was still able to get parliamentary approval for that. And there are some other examples, but Menzies never reflected in any great length about his difficulty with the Senate.
Just a final question about Menzies and women. Okay. I understand about Ms. Lewis, but I think when one of her brothers died, Menzies went down to Wesley College and announced the news to her younger brother, who was still at school. I just wonder whether Menzies was ever going to marry someone like Miss Lewis. You look out, he married Patty, and then later on, I'm not making any improper suggestion here, but the person he was closest to was Francis McNichol, to whom he gave his papers, who I interviewed for my book. And the question was, he seemed to get on very well with Frances, but she was never a person who was of the capability to write his papers. So, and that was one of the reasons why all the Menzies papers were held up for so long, and then later on the family held them up, and so they were more recently released. But he seemed to be very comfortable with someone like Frances McNichol, but she wasn't a kind of intellectually challenging person, whereas I suspect that, and Patty had her interest in roads and garbage removal and was a very tough and very smart woman, but she wasn't going to intellectually challenge Murphy, Menzies. The only one who was really probably likely to intellectually challenge Menzies was Ms. Lewis, and it didn't get very far.
No, it didn't. Look, that's a difficult question, Jared. In terms of Friends of McNicoll, I'll make some comments about that and then about women generally. You know, the Friends of McNicoll interviews are very interesting because she's clearly out of her depth in interviewing him. And I've listened to some of these on reel-to-reel tapes at the National Library. And she often poses questions but gets information factually wrong and he has to correct her. And then over time, he just essentially talks. He mentions a topic, you know, school, and he'll just go on and talk about it. Or the interview will start and he will say, now I've got something I want to say that you should know for your book. So she's not a particularly probing interviewer. My impression of her was that she had met Menzies at a dinner party and was politically connected, and he seemed to like her and find her interesting in a social sense, but she'd never written a book before or after. And he got on well with her, but she was essentially a flatterer of him. And
that's what he liked.
That's what he liked. Indeed, he did. Elizabeth May Couchman, who's one of the important people in the formation of the Liberal Party with the Australian National Women's League and so on, he did have a respect for women. He did talk about women being equal partners in the creation of the Liberal Party and sharing positions and having authority and influence and so on. And, you know, a lot of women voted Liberal for many, many, many years. So I wouldn't say that he's anti-women or anything like that. I don't think you're suggesting that. But it's an interesting relationship with Enid Lyons, which was... I know Anne knows all about that much more than I do. But it is a very interesting relationship because she, of course, was made Vice President of the Executive Council in 1949, but didn't have a portfolio in Cabinet. And she was quite cranky about that and didn't enjoy that time at all. She was essentially sitting there while all the men were talking about their issues, and she had really no authority to talk about anything in anyone else's portfolio because she didn't have a portfolio. And it's not surprising that she left at the next election. And she in 1951, and she thought that she was essentially there as a public relations exercise, which may be a little bit harsh, but there's some terrific correspondence between Menzies and Enid Lyons later in life where she is quite brutal in her assessment of Menzies and thinks that Menzies, you know, in the 1930s had it was too ambitious in trying to replace Joe Lyons as Prime Minister, and that's quite interesting to delve into as well. And, you know, of course, Menzies never promoted any other women to a cabinet or ministry position after that.
Many thanks, Troy.
Well, I had the pleasure of interviewing Frances McNicoll, and I asked the questions and gave the answers, so...
I think that's what Menzies did.
But she had some nice social gossip, I'll tell you about it sometime. Look, many thanks to Troy Bramston for a great performance tonight, and as was mentioned, I mean, it's 20 years since Ellen Martin's biography, and in that period Martin had access to some material, but so much more material has become available after the McNicoll papers are open, after Heather Henderson's book released a lot of material, and Heather Henderson in recent years has released a lot of material that wasn't available before. But you've made terrific use of it, and you're a great communicator, and you've given us a great story tonight with a historical overreach, but also a look at the person of Robert Menzies, and you've got a pretty good balance there. So well done. Good luck with the book, and as I said, there are copies for it on sale tonight. No doubt you'll write another 9 in the next decade or so, and we'll see you back then. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.